Welcome to the London School of Economics International Inequalities Institute. It's so lovely to see so many people here. We're holding this meeting as a kind of gallery event, a seminar, so that we can discuss. And so if you'd like to have your videos on, that would be really welcome. It's a kind of weird time when we hardly get to see each other. And yeah, if you're able to keep your videos on, that would be very welcome. It'd be lovely to see you all. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Alpa Shah. I'm an associate professor of anthropology here at the London School of Economics. I'm also convening the Global Economies of Care theme at the International Inequalities Institute. It's a real pleasure to chair and host this event today. The COVID pandemic has revealed so many multiple forms of crisis to us, laid them bare, inequalities that have always existed but have somehow been forced onto our screens in a way in which we cannot, ignore. It's an amazing time, at a time when inequalities are being exacerbated, but also a time when perhaps, there are new solidarities that can be formed, new issues that can be brought into the mainstream of discussion, which perhaps weren't there before, were being hidden. And I think the issue of domestic workers and the inequalities they face is one of these issues, important issues. So it's such a pleasure to think about with you the multiple crises of inequalities faced by domestic workers, and think about them across three continents and across three countries. So, which is India, the UK, and Argentina for this event. It's a real pleasure that we have with us today three fantastic speakers with long-term experience of working on domestic workers in these three different locations. And so I just want to briefly introduce to you who those are, and just lay out how the event will be structured. And we also have two fantastic discussants who I want to introduce to you. And then I will, yeah, we will kick off. So we have with us Neha Vadhavan. She joins us from the International Labour Organization in New Delhi, where she is the National Project Coordinator of the Work in Freedom program. That's the Work in Freedom program across India. She is actually a political scientist by training, and her research focuses around issues of mobility, gender, citizenship in South Asia. She had a PhD. She was awarded a PhD in international politics from Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, and she taught for some years at the Ambedkar University in Delhi. Neha has carried out extensive research on gender and labor migration, and focused especially on domestic workers in both India and in Nepal over the last 15 years. She's worked with the government of India and with Nepal in different capacities to try to inform policy making on socioeconomic development and labor migration. It's a real pleasure to have you with us, Neha. Thank you for joining us. Dr. Joyce Jiang, she is a lecturer in human resource management at the University of York. She's also with us as a trustee of the Voice of Domestic Workers in London. She's been researching migrant labor in lots of different ways, and migrant and domestic workers in particular, their social movements. She brings a kind of artistic dimension. She's looking at the politicized nature of art. She has worked on various art-based methods, including using photography, video, and has had a number of exhibitions on migrant domestic workers in different galleries in London and New York on her work. Lorena Pobleta, yeah, welcome, Joyce. It's lovely to have you too. And Lorena is our next speaker, and she joins us from Argentina, where she's a researcher at the National Research Council, a professor at the San Martin University. She is currently also an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow. She holds a PhD in sociology from the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. And her research focuses on paid domestic work legislation in Latin America and the platform for domestic workers in Argentina. It's wonderful to have you too, Lorena. Thank you. So, what we're going to do in this event is I'm going to pose a few, three questions, which each of the speakers are going to address in their presentation, so that we can maybe attempt to think comparatively across countries together, especially in our discussion. And once they've done their presentations, which will be no more than 10 minutes long, which will be answering these questions, which I'll set out in a minute, I'm going to hand over to two amazing discussants who join us today. So we have Professor Louise Ryan. She is directing the Global Diversities and Inequalities Research Centre at the London Metropolitan University. She wears so many hats and has done lots of incredible research over the decades, and it's a real pleasure to have you with us, Louise. Thank you for joining us. And then we're going to be the last discussant is going to be our very own Shalini Grover, who is an anthropologist and a research officer on the global economies of care theme here at the Institute of International Institute of Inequalities. Dr. Shalini Grover has published very widely on marriage, love, kinship, legal pluralism, labor relations, and care work. She has a monograph in 2011, Marriage, Love, Caste, and Kinship Support, which has been recently republished internationally by Routledge. And she's working right now on her second monograph, Caregivers of the 20th and 21st Century, Race, Coloniality, and Global Elites in India. And so it's really wonderful to have Shalini with all of this incredible experience with us today, reflecting on these three presentations across three continents. So the three questions that all the presenters are going to address, and we came up with these questions collectively through a discussion that we had prior to this event in order to help us think comparatively together in this event itself with you, the audience, who I hope will participate in the discussion. So I just want to lay out the three questions for you, which we felt were very important to think about. So the first question is about the COVID-19 pandemic in particular, and the inequalities it's revealed to us, which have been faced by domestic care workers. So what has this pandemic revealed about inequalities faced by domestic workers? So that's the first question. The second question that all three are going to address is, how does the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on domestic care workers make us reflect on the question of what is work? What is work itself? We have so many debates going on what essential workers are, and especially in England. Have domestic workers been included in such debates? Where do they stand, right, in the question of what is work? And the last question that we're going to discuss across the countries is, what, if any, new work relations have emerged between employers and domestic workers through this current moment, through this crisis, if you like. So, okay. So over to our first speaker, Dr. Neha Vadhavan. Welcome.
Thank you, Alba. I hope I'm audible. I want to start by just thanking you and Shalini for inviting me to speak at this panel. And I think in the larger context of talking about equalities in the world of work, with reference to domestic work today in the wake of the COVID pandemic. To better manage the 10 minutes allotted to me, I would like to spend a minute or two on some characteristics of domestic workers in India before responding to the first and the third question together, and then linking my thoughts on the second question. So to begin with, I'd just like to start by saying that domestic work is seen as undignified work, and feudal racist and casteist prejudices are embedded in the treatment meted out to domestic workers, who are seen as menial workers doing unclean jobs. As a result, domestic workers in India lack respect, legal recognition, and access to basic rights as workers in most provinces or states, as we call them in India. Domestic workers come from marginalized backgrounds, indigenous and backward communities that reside in underdeveloped regions within the country. And many of them are Dalits, and several belong to religious minorities as well. A large majority of domestic workers work as live out and part-time workers, servicing the burgeoning middle classes in Indian cities, while a substantial number also work as live-in full-time workers, sleeping in kitchens and household corners while working up to 16-hour workdays. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to be able to provide concrete numbers on domestic workers in the workforce, as we don't have exhaustive data available. But estimates range from a conservative 400,000 to about 4 million domestic workers in the country, which to my mind, I think would still be an underestimation given the existing evidence on just the sheer size of the Indian middle class. I'd also like to add that many domestic workers are migrants. Many come from Nepal to work in the country, as India has porous borders and a long-standing agreement on a visa-free entry and exit policy with Nepal. Now, at the ILO, we work closely with trade unions organizing domestic workers and social partners in states of origin for migrant domestic workers. And with colleagues in our project, I'm in the process of putting together a publication on the impact of COVID-19 on domestic workers, which we have tentatively titled Exacerbated Vulnerabilities, as we do believe that inequalities have sharpened since the outbreak, and the overwhelming feedback from the ground has been that domestic workers have been one of the worst impacted categories of informal sector workers, while they may have been impacted in different ways based on their employment terms. Now, just to recap quickly, India went into a total lockdown from March 24th till the 31st of May. And we are currently in the sixth phase of a gradual unlocking process. During this time and since the lockdown, part-time live-out workers have been reporting the overwhelming loss of employment and denial of back wages across the length and breadth of the country. In addition, harassment by landlords for rent, no money to buy food, and restricted health access have led many to leave cities with families in tow. And I think those the photographs and the reportage that we've seen on workers walking back has been a shocking revelation to many, but not to some of us who've been actually looking at migration patterns for some time. Those who stayed back have partially returned to work after the gradual lifting of the lockdown, despite limited public transportation services. I think it's important to take note here that in pockets where domestic workers were unionized, workers did demand for their wages and they were paid to workers in many cases. Yet domestic workers live with the constant fear of losing their jobs due to their living conditions in city slums, where social distancing is a very big challenge. And the continuing stigmatization in the workplace, stemming from employers' notions of the meniality of domestic work and domestic workers being corona carriers. You know, this is quite ironic, I feel, considering that there have been numerous news reports on contact tracing, which indicate that employers have actually passed on the infection to domestic workers in several Indian cities. Now, and this perception has fueled, unfortunately, arbitrary restrictions being placed on the entry and exit and the movement of live-out domestic workers by resident welfare associations in gated communities and apartment complexes within Indian cities. Now, live-in workers have reported further restrictions on their mobility. In addition to continuous working hours with minimum rest, increased workloads and resulting harassment due to the fact that all family members are being restricted within households during the lockdown and after it. Employers have refused to release live-in domestic workers who wanted to return home, and they continue to work near captive in their workplace. Indian domestic workers working overseas are reportedly stranded abroad. Some have been turned out by their employers without settlement of dues, while others are working overtime without rest and at heightened risk of abuse. Some have returned with the government's aid, but their dues have not been settled. And the existing legal framework I think works against migrant workers, because once they return to their countries of origin, claiming these wages and the processes and the hurdles that exist are actually very difficult to transcend once they return. Now, both types of workers are at risk of contracting the virus from their employers, and they have been so. Denial and non-payment of wages have emerged as another common issue. Reports of increasing domestic violence within households and the emerging analysis on increasing burdens of the unpaid work on informal women workers is just another indicator of how existing vulnerabilities have been exacerbated. Now, in the Indian case, I'd like to highlight a pertinent and, what was a very worrisome factor for us and has been, is that despite notifications on minimum wages for domestic workers in some states and the continuing struggle to implement the existing laws for domestic workers, their rights in the workplace are seldom recognized because their workplace itself is not legally recognized. And due to COVID, there were some unprecedented directives to employers of informal workers that came out by the state and central governments. Yet domestic workers could not benefit from any of these because they mostly lie outside the ambit of benefiting as workers eligible for relief. To my knowledge, I think only Meghalaya took out one state level notification saying that relief has to be given to domestic workers. And domestic workers in states where the Domestic Worker Welfare Board exists, for example, in Tamil Nadu, have actually struggled and received some compensation. It's peanuts. It's only 1,000 rupees, to cover for the entire period of the COVID outbreak. But it is a small win for the domestic workers movement at large. The fact that the workplace is not legally regulated has been one of the main obstacles in enacting a law to protect domestic workers. And this needs to be something that needs to be collectively strategized upon and I think it'll be essential to translate these demands into a reality. Now, the work from home regime coupled with the lockdown has precipitated a crisis within households. Women employers having to balance paid and unpaid work with all family members being at home. Live-in workers, of course, have reported increased time on tasks that took lesser time earlier, for example, cooking and cleaning, as household members who aren't usually home are home all day now, right? Working women employers felt an immense pressure and perhaps the need to revisit the sexual division of labor debate within the household, is timely, because this is an unresolved question which has been invisibilized in the Indian context by the availability of cheap domestic work. Some opinion pieces have even raised questions about the importance of domestic workers in our lives and if they should be classified as an essential workforce. In many cases, it was heartening to come across working women, especially, who have raised their voices against these resident welfare associations' decisions to restrict the entry of domestic workers, as they're desperate for help at home. Now, in such a scenario, upholding international labor standards and ILO Conventions 189, they garner renewed significance because they play a critical role in actually looking at how decent work for domestic workers can be upheld. With a renewed commitment to 189 and together with the ILO Convention 190, I think we need to draw attention to the urgency of preventing violence and harassment in the home as a workplace. While the state's responsibility to protect vulnerable workers has found resonance, we must also address the responsibility of employers and civil society at large to work towards a better normal. Moreover, the role of domestic work, both paid and unpaid, in social reproduction in general, and in caring for COVID-affected patients and households at this juncture in particular, must be recognized and upheld. I'll stop there. Thanks, Alpa.
I'm going to hand over immediately to Joyce Jiang
Over to you, Joyce.
Thanks, Alpha. Yeah, I'm going to talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected migrant domestic workers in the UK based on my 10-year research on this group of workers in this society. So before I address three questions raised by the chair, I'm going to briefly introduce the context of this group of workers in the UK. When I say migrant domestic workers, I refer to people who enter this society under a very special visa category called the Overseas Domestic Work Visa. So how to get this visa? They have to work for a particular employer abroad for at least 1 year full time. And that employer decides to move to UK and bring them to the UK as well. In this case, they can apply for this visa. In 2012, the government has introduced significant changes to this visa category. So before 2012, migrant domestic workers are able to renew the visa every year, as long as they are continuously hired as a full-time domestic workers in private households. So until 5 years, they can apply for a settlement, and 1 year after settlement, they are entitled to citizenship in this country. However, since 2012, they are currently tied to a non-renewable 6 months overseas domestic work visa. So after 6 months, they become either undocumented or they will be deported. I mean, the only support mechanism available to them in this society is called the National Referral Mechanism, which is the framework to identify and support the victim of human trafficking and modern slavery. So if they are identified as a victim of human trafficking, modern slavery, they can extend their visa for up to 2 years. But again, this has no implication for settlement. And also there is a historical gender and racialized tendency in this sector. So majority of migrant workers, domestic workers, are women from Asian and African countries such as Filipinos, Indians, Pakistanis, Indonesians, Moroccans, Nigerians, Ugandans, and Ghanaians. And also, I mean, I've been working on this group of workers for 10 years. I mean, my main community partner is the Voice of Domestic Workers in London, so I'm the trustee board of the organization. So it is initially a self-help group led by domestic workers. It was established in 2009 and affiliated to United Union of Food and Hospitality Branch. In 2017, it became a charity organization. So I'll be working with them to produce survey interviews, produce a documentary film and exhibitions as well. But today I'm going to present some of the data from my research in collaboration with this charity organization. So the first question, what has the COVID-19 pandemic revealed about the inequalities faced by domestic care workers? I mean, I would say the pandemic has highlighted and exacerbated existing inequalities. So I'm going to discuss existing challenges, inequalities faced by migrant domestic workers before COVID-19 in this country. The first significant challenge is a peculiar nature of the domestic work sector. So obviously there's no shop floor. They're working in private households. I mean, it's very difficult to monitor working conditions and health and safety behind private doors. And they're also being, you know, enmeshed in class relations, integrated with the gendered and racialized structures of oppression. So this means that they're not only suffering from low pay, long working hours, non-compliance of national wage, but they are also subject to severe physical, verbal and sexual abuse. In 2018, we conducted a survey with more than 500 migrant domestic workers from The Voice. And the average weekly working hours is 91 hours, while the average weekly salary is between £300 and £400. So if you calculate hourly rate here, it is far below the national wage in the UK. And only 31% of them reported they had their individual room in employers' houses, which means majority of them have to sleep on the floor, on the sofa, or in their employers' houses. Less than half reported they had enough food to eat, and almost 77% of them reported they have been either physically, verbally, or sexually abused. So this indicates the existence of modern slavery in the sector. And the second particular barrier they face in the society is a legal precarity. I've mentioned about the visa change in 2012. So the current non-renewable 6 months visa has created a large number of undocumented migrant domestic workers in the UK who are invisible, fearful, living outside the protection of all laws. For example, I mean, in The Voice, the majority of members have become undocumented at this moment. And also the 6 months like restricted visa has made it very difficult for domestic workers to get access to UK employment law in practice. I mean, legally, they're entitled to national minimum wage and other employment rights in the UK, but it's very difficult for them to bring their case to employment tribunals because currently, the average processing time of a case in employment tribunal is longer than 6 months. This means that they won't have enough time to do that. And also, they are excluded from the health and safety regulation in the UK because they're working in private households. So now I'm going to talk about how this COVID-19 pandemic has further reinforced all these marginalities and inequalities. In terms of economic risk, I think there's a big issue for both living and live-out domestic workers is the loss of jobs. In April, 1 month after lockdown, the Voice of Domestic Workers has financially supported 50 domestic workers who lost their jobs during the lockdown. But this is only a 1 month like time frame. I assume the scale of job loss is much larger than this. And which, I mean, by losing a job, obviously, they can't afford the rent, and they can't buy the food, and there's a survival issue. And for living domestic workers, for those who still have the job, and they're also experiencing pay reduction or even no pay, because very often the employers will say they're experiencing financial difficulties as well, and their salary is, they're losing their own salary, so they stop, you know, paying full salary to domestic workers. But also their workloads have increased because obviously they have to take care of, you know, elderly people, children, and whole family during lockdown. And migrant domestic workers do not have resources to public funds, even though they're facing poverty and destitution in this society. And also there are significant physical and psychological risks, and the regulations related to social distancing hygiene measures are very difficult to be enforced in private households. So many employers do not provide masks and gloves, and many of living domestic workers have been locked in their individual bedroom. So they're not allowed to go out, you know, to exercise or even to do basic grocery shopping. So it's a common, you know, to lock them by employees. And for undocumented migrant domestic workers, they are unable to access a free medical care in the UK. We've got a few cases where domestic workers have caught the virus from their employees, but they cannot go to hospital because there's no free care available to them. And during the lockdown, there has been increasing domestic workers who have reported the abuse to the charity organization, The Voice. And there has been increasing number of workers who want to be referred to national referral mechanism, which indicates the scale of abuse has been expanding during lockdown. I mean, the implication for mental health, there's a lot of stress and frustration. I have produced a briefing on the impacts of COVID-19 on domestic workers. You can check it in case you want to get to know some more information and some case studies. So the second question, how does the COVID-19 pandemic has made us reflect upon the question of what is work? I think this, you know, particularly time period pandemic has highlighted the traditional debate on, you know, whether domestic workers are real workers, because in many societies, they're still being called maids and servants. So whether they are market work or family work, traditionally domestic work is linked to notion of social reproduction. So their work status is very often neglected in a lot of policy framework, particularly during the pandemic, because they're essential workers who are providing personal care for elderly people and children. But I mean, their essential work status is neglected in the policy framework in this society, and they face the poverty and destitution. There are some governments who have officially classified migrant domestic workers as essential workers, but this is not a common case at a global level. And also in the UK, the current, you know, support mechanism, the national referral mechanism, has not clearly identified migrant domestic workers as workers. It's a framework which identifies them as victims of modern slavery. So it's, you know, there's a potential danger of victimizing this group of workers instead of recognizing them as workers and their agency. So last year, I organized an exhibition in Cubitt's Gallery in London. It's called Domestic Work is Work. I'm trying to deliver this message to the public audience. So the third question, what, if any, new work relations have emerged between employers and domestic care workers? I wouldn't say I've witnessed a new form of employment relations, but I would say the pandemic has made employment relations more exploitative, precarious, and informal. I've presented some data of, you know, reinforced labor exploitations. And there are more employees who fire migrant domestic workers without any short, without any notice or extremely short notice. And they prefer, you know, taking more temporary fixed term, you know, short-term domestic workers. So their employment contracts become highly precarious and informal. And they also they face long-term uncertainty for job opportunities because some employees are still very sensitive to virus. They never know when they can have a job back. And even when they receive a job offer, their employment conditions have become very harsh. I remember in April, there was one domestic workers received a new job offer leaving a position, but there's one condition, she cannot go out before the end of year. This means you'll be locked within, you know, a room for more than 8 months, actually. So the conditions have become very harsh. I mean, there has been increasing bodily surveillance and tensions. This is nothing new in the sector. Very often employees will install CCTV to monitor what they're doing. But now I think the scale has increased. They cannot go out at all. And we've got quite a few cases. They cannot go out to buy food. So boys has been delivering food to some domestic workers locked in individual bedrooms. Decreasing mobility, which means even if they come across very abusive employees, they cannot escape or change employees at this moment because of current climate. So, I mean, they get pretty much get stuck in exploitative employment relations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joyce. Over to Lorena Poblete.
Thank you. Okay, I would like to thank to Alpa, Sasha, and Shalini Grover for the invitation to participate in this webinar about the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on domestic care work. To illustrate the Argentine case, first I will introduce some characteristics of the domestic work sector. Then I will present the public policies to deal with COVID-19 pandemic and the consequence for the domestic care workers. In Argentina, there are 1.4 million domestic workers, almost all of them are women. Domestic workers occupy a significant place in the labor market because they represent 5.6% of the labor force, 17% of working women, and 22% of female employees. Only 9% of them are migrant workers from neighboring countries. The majority of domestic workers enter the sector after losing a job in other sectors, following a divorce, or when their children went to school. The majority are between 45 and 54 years old, and most of them did not complete primary education. Concerning their income level, 40% of domestic workers are poor, meaning they earn less than 1.5 minimum wage. And 52% are extremely poor because they earn less than the minimum wage. Regarding labor arrangement, only 1.8 are living domestic workers, 56% are live out full-time or part-time workers, and 42% work by the hour. 44% of domestic workers work 16 weekly hours or less, 32% work between 16 and 34 weekly hours, and 24% labor more than 35 weekly hours. The majority work for one employer. However, 34% work for various employers. Within this group, 70% work for two employers and 30% for three or more. Although in Argentina, the difference between cleaning and care work is almost imperceptible, because the idiosyncratic way to perform this work combined the two tasks, 8% of domestic workers declare that they perform only care work, 22% declare that they perform both, and 70% declare to perform cleaning work. Informality is almost the norm for the sector since 2013, when the new law on domestic work was approved. Formalization has been increasing, however, only 24% of domestic workers are formal workers. That means only 1 to 4 domestic workers have access to labor and social security rights. In mid-March, when the COVID-19 pandemic struck South America, Argentina's government locked down the country and declared a state of emergency. Only essential workers carrying a special authorization were allowed to work. This restriction lasted 7 months. Although in Argentina, traditionally, domestic workers perform simultaneously care and cleaning work, only workers who perform exclusively care work for children or elderly people were considered essential workers. Thus, 70% of domestic workers couldn't work during the shutdown. Employees must continue to pay wages and social security contribution during this period. Furthermore, redundancy was prohibited. Then, if the labor relationship was interrupted, the employer has to double the severance payment because the layoff would be classified as unjustified. Since March, three different scenarios appear. First, employers declare that domestic workers perform care work instead of cleaning tasks. This change in their status allows them to have the authorization to work as essential workers. In the second scenario, employers continue to pay wages and contribution, particularly in the case of a formalized labor relationship. In some cases, domestic workers receive the total amount of their wages. In others, employers reduce unilaterally the number of monthly working hours to lower the salary. In the third scenario, domestic workers were dismissed even though redundancy was banned. Since the Special Labor Tribunal for Domestic Workers closed during the pandemic, domestic workers are not able to claim the severance payment. Because of the growth of informality in the sector, only 24% of domestic workers are entitled to labor and social security rights. Therefore, only for these formal workers, their employers are legally obliged to pay full wages and social contribution. During the first month, almost all formal employers comply with their obligations. However, over the time, they started to lower the wages by reducing the declared working time or by not complying with the wage increase established by the state. For informal workers, the situation was very different because they do not have rights to claim. Hence, most of them lost their jobs during the pandemic. Some of them were informed by their employers, but for others, employers simply stopped paying the wages and never answered their calls. During the lockdown, many employers lost their source of income, or saw their income diminished. That was the main reason why they couldn't comply with their obligation as employer. While the state supports employment in other sectors by paying part of the employee's wage, for domestic work employers, no measure had been taken. As a way to ensure a minimum income to these workers who have very small salaries and live in poverty, the state allows them to have access to the unconditional cash transfer program created during the pandemic. This program started as one-time cash transfer, but it was extended, allowing beneficiaries to receive 4 cash transfers in 8 months, from April to November. This contingent solution leaves today many domestic workers without income. In November, the government authorized all domestic workers to return to work. As part of the COVID protocol, domestic workers are not allowed to use public transportation and can only work in one workplace, even if they have more than one employer. While this protective measure aims to reduce the risk of infection for domestic workers, they seem problematic in their implementation. Because domestic workers cannot use public transportation, the employer must be able to provide a private transportation. But if the employer cannot guarantee that, the domestic worker cannot work. Also, for 34% of domestic workers who work for more than one employer, they must choose one workplace and quit the other jobs. In this case, the domestic workers' wages will necessarily decrease. In summary, since domestic workers are one of the most vulnerable workers because they work in the employer's house in close proximity, the government established some measures to protect them during the COVID-19 pandemic. However, this formal protection did not become real protection. Most of them appear as constraints to work. In some cases, employers impose domestic workers to work as false care workers or to legally quit. In other cases, employers decided unilaterally to change the contractual arrangement or even to terminate the labor relationship without notifying the domestic worker. According to domestic workers, they had to accept to lower the wage. Additionally, they lost part of their income due to dismissal. As poor workers, they could have access to the special COVID cash transfer program, which provides a small amount of money every 2 months. Consequently, during this critical time, domestic workers have to face the consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic without public policies suitable for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lorena, and also for all the speakers for keeping time so beautifully. So many thoughts already occurring to my mind, but I'm going to hand over to Louise Ryan to kick off the discussion with a few minutes of reflection on the different issues that the speakers have drawn out. And then after that, Shalini Grover.
Thank you, Alpa, and thank you very much to the three speakers. I'm not going to take up a lot of time because I'm sure the audience members have lots of questions that they would also like to raise for discussion. But just some reflections listening to those three fascinating presentations. I think what it really behoves us to do is to differentiate across these very broad categories of what do we actually mean by domestic workers. And I think that came through in all three presentations, from three very different geographical contexts, from India, Argentina, and here in the UK. What we can clearly observe are some similarities, some clear similarities in the conditions of these different domestic workers across the three contexts, and how those have been exacerbated by COVID-19 and the associated lockdown. But what's also apparent are the particularities of these individuals in those different contexts, and that also came through in the presentation. So I think it's about recognizing shared experience, but also the particularities and the peculiarities of specific contexts. And particularly in relation to Joyce's presentation, looking at the migration status, the very restricted migration status of domestic workers who come in on that visa, coming into the UK, and how their rights have gradually decreased over the years. And Joyce showed that very clearly with her slides. And I mean, if I'm allowed to ask a question to Joyce for later, you told us about the nationality of the migrant workers, but you didn't tell us about the nationality of the employers. And I'd be quite interested to know who are these employers and if there are particular nationalities that tend to predominate through that visa scheme. And I think what also very much comes to light in all of this is about the construction, the social construction of who are we actually talking about and how do we define these different kinds of work. And that came through very much in Lorena's presentation about whether we're talking about individuals as care workers or as cleaners, and how those categorizations can have a real impact on people's lives. And again, in Neha's presentation, we saw how those kind of cultural stereotypes and religious stereotypes can define particular kinds of workers in very low status positions and reinforce those kinds of negative stigmatization of particular individuals who hold those roles. And it made me think about what's been happening here in the UK. And for those of you, I know a lot of you are international attendees today, but some of you will be familiar with the UK context. And during the pandemic, at the beginning of the lockdown, particularly around March, April, we had this phenomenon of clap for carers. Initially, it was called clap for the NHS, clap for the National Health Service. And every Thursday night in the middle of the lockdown, people would stand outside their doors and clap collectively. You'd see all your neighbours standing, clapping for the NHS. And quite quickly, that got transformed into clap for carers, which was an attempt to acknowledge the very valued and very dangerous work that was being done by carers, particularly within care homes rather than private domestic homes. But that sort of transformation from NHS to carers showed some kind of attempt at public recognition of who is actually doing this work and the way in which that different kind of work gets valued. But of course, that excluded domestic care workers who were not particularly on the agenda when it came to defining who's doing this work and where is that work being done. And it just also made me think about Brexit. And sorry, but I could not let this opportunity go by without mentioning Brexit. It becomes official on the 1st of January. It's just around the corner. And this is going to have massive implications for the kinds of people who do a lot of, not the kind of work that Joyce was talking about, people who come in on a particular visa, but I'm thinking in particular about the thousands and thousands of migrants who work as domestic workers in an unofficial capacity. And there are very large numbers of migrants who do that. And these are often working as cleaners in private homes. And of course, once we move to the new points-based immigration system on the 1st of January in this country, you need 70 points to be able to qualify for a visa. And you also need to reach a certain income threshold to qualify for a visa. And the threshold is currently at £25,600 a year. And there's absolutely no cleaner in the UK who earns that kind of money. So it's probably going to drive a lot of these individuals, including EU nationals, underground and into an irregular, undocumented position where they'll be even more vulnerable to exploitation. And that kind of takes me back to that original discussion about defining the different categories. And what we will increasingly see, I think, from the 1st of January is white European migrants coming into that increasingly precarious, vulnerable and insecure status because of the new points-based immigration system. And particularly those working very much cash in hand, with no rights, no entitlements within private domestic homes will be a group of increasing vulnerability, I suggest, after the 1st of January in this country. So something we need to be paying attention to. So those are just some observations, listening to the papers and also trying to maybe relate it to the UK context, especially in the light of Brexit. But thank you again for three really stimulating and fascinating papers.
Thank you so much for some very thoughtful comments, Louise. I'm sure we can take some of those up in discussion. Over to you, Shalini.
Okay, so let me just start by saying that I have really, really enjoyed these three absolutely rich talks by all three of you. And thank you so much, Louise, for this very insightful analysis that you just gave. I'm actually going to bring in some broad theoretical perspectives here in relation to the three talks. For me, they have, for all of us, they have facilitated a multidisciplinary and cross-cultural examination of COVID-19 in three very different nation states, directing us to a transnational connectedness out here. For future research, I find this is an interesting way to advance theoretical models on intimacy and care work. All three scholars have drawn on their own research, paying attention to cultural specificities, legal structures, intersectionalities, and most of all, also the very extreme precarity of that migrant workers and domestic workers face in their various countries. Now, taking these three different nation states, I am struck here by the global interconnectedness of structures of power. Indeed, what it re-establishes is that care is about structures of power. Care is not always homogeneous, natural, or altruistic, but is situated in a power dynamic. And therefore, care can become a form of intervention, a hopeful moment of mobilization that has brought us all together in this COVID period. I think what's important to emphasize again and again is that care work and domestic service is gendered, racialized, classed, undervalued, underrecognized, and embedded in structural inequalities. And it's important to remind ourselves time and time again that there is nothing novel about these inequalities, whether it be a catastrophe, a pandemic, an uprising, or a war. Women's reproductive labor acquires an intense scrutiny, but can also have paradoxical effects as labor roles and identities can become sentimentalized, and this racialization is key to the sentimentalization. Louise talked about the way the clapping and the sentimentalization around this clapping. It was, if we go back to 1857 in India's mutiny, the exact same thing happened to Indian ayahs who saved the lives of so many British families and their children, and how they became very sentimentalized figures. But this never, this did not shepherd a reimagination of more progressive class and gender relations. I think what's really interesting here is what is work under the pandemic. And it is a very interesting area that the speakers covered in their own nuanced ways. Now let's just go back a little and dig deeper. Domestic service in many countries and contexts has been about class achievement. But for domestic workers, it has also been a way to channel their aspirations and a route to social mobility. So the question here is, how is it being renegotiated in a time of crisis? And what all three papers show is that it's almost taken a form of a slavery, a re-slavery-like conditions that have really initiated so much precariousness that people, that domestic workers aren't getting paid. There's such a high level of harassment. So clearly the papers show us that things have so deteriorated for this already existing neglected workforce across three nations. And for the formal and unregulated labor markets, which has always functioned on an economy of favors, you know, that care is more about relationships rather than economy, I do have a few questions now for the speakers, which I hope I have. Alpa, how long do I have? Maybe, do I have another minute or so, or am I?
Sure, Shalini, sure.
Okay, so I I'm very happy to have been a part of these very first-hand accounts that all three of you have given us. Neha, I'm really, my questions to you, and I also have certain comments. So let's start with the questions. I'm interested in whether sections of the sort of Indian middle classes, and sections I'm saying, because, you know, domestic service in India is so vast, so heterogeneous, so identity-based niche now, that I'm wondering whether the employer class has finally conceded to some extent that domestic labor, paid domestic labor, is work, and they're not just saving poor subalterns from poverty. You know, have they realized that this is work? And I like to think futuristically, and I'm wondering, you know, what is the future here of domestic service and care work after this pandemic is over? And, you know, you talked, Neha, I'm also interested in the part-time workers, because you've given a really good account of your live-ins. You know, part-timers are also so indispensable in Indian households. So I'm just wondering about the nature of those relationships as well. So in terms of Joyce's presentation, I think, Louise, you know, I had exactly the same question written down. Who are the employers? Is it Asians who work for Asians? Is it, you know, are they working for the same nationality, or what's going on out here? But, you know, 76.5% of abuse is very high. And, you know, what kind of consequences is this having on the mental health of workers, Joyce? You know, the mental health is a very important aspect of domestic workers' well-being to work and survive. And Joyce, I think your contribution is also so important in many respects, because it brings in a first world country, a liberal economy that the rest of the world looks to. And you know, we're always being told that the laws and regulations are so good in the global north. But this just tells us how, you know, how it is totally invisible to state and policy analytics, the whole care domestic labor. Lorena, I think Luis covered what I was going to say. And you have also very high live outs, I saw, but I was also interested in how the live-ins are, you have a small percent of live-ins, but how their lives have been impacted with employers during COVID. So I'm going to end there. And Alpa, I hand it back to you now.
Thank you so much, Shalini. That was really wonderful from both you and Louise, such thoughtful comments and excellent questions. My suggestion is that we have a lot of people here, and I'm sure you're all waiting to contribute with your thoughts and comments. So rather than hand over immediately to the speakers to respond to Louise and Shalini, I'm going to actually open the floor and invite whoever would like to, raise a question or have a, share your thoughts.
I have a question, but
Could you identify yourself, please? If you don't mind just saying your name and before you speak, and it would be great if you can put your camera on, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I'll try. I don't have a very pretty backdrop, but I think that should.
Is that Padmaja?
Yes, it is indeed, yes.
Lovely, okay, oh, it's so nice to see you. Yeah, go on, please share your thoughts.
I had a question for Neha. So a lot of what you talked about is, of course, in a way very interesting, but in a way it's also been sort of these things have been happening and they've been kind of analyzed and researched and talked about, inequalities and lack of recognition as workers, etc. But I mean, I'm wondering, because I haven't had a chance, although I've been working, doing research with domestic workers for almost 5 to 6 years, I haven't had a chance to kind of map what have been the kind of repercussions of the COVID on domestic workers in terms of, what the sort of disciplining that used to take place earlier, which were very much caste-based and class-based in India, and the kind of body surveillance. Have you had a chance? I understand that you've done some new research during this time. So has that changed in any way, or has that kind of just been reinscribed or, sort of exacerbated, or have there been new kind of technologies of surveillance or disciplining which have come about? I mean, it's something that I would be interested in hearing about .
Thank you, Padmaja. Thanks very much for your question. Is there anybody else who wants to speak from the floor?
Thanks. My name is Alia Mirali. I'm from Pakistan and in Pakistan right now, and I'm a PhD student at LSE Gender. And I'm working on the political subjectivities of domestic workers in Pakistan. I'm curious as to whether in all of the different sites that the presenters discussed, my question is sort of already geared towards the Indian context because it's so similar to that of Pakistan. But at least in the Pakistani context, there has been a rather widespread rejection of the very existence of COVID-19. There's large sections of the population that just simply, refuse to, they just don't believe it exists. And even though this this perception is not just amongst a particular class, it varies, but there are also class correlations with this perception. And given that domestic workers their employers belong to a class that is, hypersensitive in most cases about coronavirus. I'm wondering how that sort of tallies with these perceptions that exist in many working class communities, at least in the Pakistani context at large. So I'm wondering also how that gender and then that particular form of work put women from these communities in particular positions in the work context, and then in the slum context or in the home or community context, how that sort of, I don't know, how that interplays with these kinds of perceptions that there is no such thing as COVID. And the second thing I'm wondering about is, given the widespread rate of unemployment amongst men in these communities, I'm sure that domestic workers, their lives, their households, their communities have been impacted by the layoffs. And so I'm wondering if anyone has investigated what the effects of that have been, and on domestic violence in their own homes, not just in the employers' homes, but in their own homes where they live.
Yeah, that's a great question as well. Thanks. I have a reflection on that, but I will invite Grace Wild to speak first, please.
Hi, it's just a thank you. I'm an MSc student on the inequalities course at LSE, and it's just a quick question for Joyce, really, about whether you've seen members of the Voice of Domestic Workers increasingly kind of unionise and campaign for their rights, kind of because of that heroising rhetoric about key workers, or whether the kind of issue of visa status is too strong a factor, kind of counteracting that. So just interested in the kind of energizing to campaign, and whether the discourse has had an effect, if that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Grace. Thomas Chambers. Hi, Tom.
Sorry, just finding my unmute button. Thanks so much, Alpa. Thanks very much for these really fascinating presentations. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice a little bit here, but hopefully I can get a question out. I was just wondering about, and you know, perhaps it's something that you don't specifically have data on, but perhaps it's something that you're sort of aware of from your broader engagements as well. Thinking about the Indian context, where I do most of my research, and I think that's probably likely something that, you know, is a factor in various other parts of the world as well. There's always been this long kind of complex relationship between questions of pollution and domestic labor. You know, is domestic laborer seen as a sort of polluting body, as an alien body in the home, perhaps, or are they not? You know, and the, you know, there's sort of tensions perhaps around that. But I wonder if you have a sense perhaps of how, you know, the current sort of crisis and the emergence of COVID-19 and so on has kind of transfigured those kind of narratives around pollution and domestic labor, and how that might have interplayed in the sort of embodied practice of domestic workers themselves. So are domestic workers, you know, finding themselves having to re-portray a sort of particular image of hygiene, sort of anti-pollution work, so to speak, perhaps even that become part of that that sort of set of daily embodied practices, as well as, you know, a broader discourse?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Thomas. There's a question from Ratna Sudarshan. Ratna, would you like to ask your question yourself, or would you like me to read it out?
Well, either way.
Go ahead, Ratna. It'll be nice to see you, hear your voice if you can. Okay. If we can.
I'm not sure that I can put on my video because I...
Don't worry.
So I just speak, but thank you. That was a really interesting set of presentations. My question really to all of you, I think all of you have pointed out that there's increased restrictions on mobility, which is absolutely true, and that there's a genuine fear on the part of employers right now because of the health situation, you know, and as Neha said, restriction of entry of domestic workers. My question really is this a temporary situation? Do you expect things to return to what it was, or are we going to see long-term changes in the nature of you know, domestic service? Is there going to be a shift towards full-time work where it's possible? It's not always possible. So I mean, what are the long-term changes that you see as likely to happen as a result of this enforced 10 months of, you know, very peculiar relationships?
Thank you, Ratna. I've got Georgiana Tukulet. Georgiana, are you with us?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me? Yourself, please.
Hi. I am Georgiana Tukulet. I am a visiting faculty at Central European University. Thank you very much for your presentations and this workshop. My question is about another aspect, which I might actually have missed on it as I was trying to access the workshop. In case it was addressed, I apologize. I was wondering about whether any of the presenters have spoken about the relational aspect of care. So what I have in mind is the issue of heart transplant problem. So basically, carers tend to take care of families in wealthy democracies, while also at the same time, when there are migrants, they also leave behind their own people to care for. That would be children and elderly. And so from this perspective, the loss on the human loss is actually affecting others left behind. So of course, there are losses in terms of the legal status and the economic losses on wage losses, et cetera, et cetera. But I was wondering if it was addressed, the problem of the heart transplant, and how this other relational loss has impacted society as a whole, or those migrants and their own personal relationships. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Georgiana. If I may take my the prerogative of being chair to also pose a question to the speakers, and it's drawing on what a number of people, including Shalini, Georgiana, you know, Alia, have said, which is I'm wondering whether, you know, whether if we think comparatively across these cases, we may come up with some new analysis about the relational aspect of care, or, you know, of domestic work or care, or what is work, you know, under these circumstances. Because, you know, as Shalini said, you know, what's often driving the motivations for workers is, you know, an aspiration for social mobility, right? So you find domestic workers back here in England who've come from India, who might be leaving behind families in which they're also employing domestic workers, you know, back at home. As Neha pointed out in her presentation, you know, we've got these new arrangements that are new issues that are being highlighted with employer, you know, the crisis of, you know, work within the household that women are facing, you know, and them arguing on behalf of their community housing, you know, that no, these domestic workers are essential workers, you know, because so you've got these kind of multiple chains of exploitation that are taking place and multiple crises that are kind of going down the scales. And so I'm wondering, what is the kind of, you know, how do we unravel this in terms of what are the kind of positive things that are coming out of this? Where are the battles being fought that could turn this around? And, you know, especially with both Neha and Joyce here working with the ILO, you know, thinking about mobilization voice, you know, with the voices of domestic workers thinking about mobilization. I mean, is there something that is coming out of this moment that makes us rethink, you know, the nature of work, that enables us to fight in new ways for what is work, you know, for the work, for all the unpaid work that is never counted as work, which includes domestic workers, but which includes so much more. Anyway, yeah. So we're supposed to kind of close in 5 minutes, actually. That's the end of the session is supposed to be 3:45. So I do want to give all the speakers a chance to respond, the three speakers. You know, you can obviously choose whatever questions you'd like to pick. But before I do that, I will give Paro Mishra very quick. If you could be very quick with your question, that'd be great, because we'd like to hear from the speakers as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Alpa. I'll be very quick. So my question is to Neha. Neha, especially with the Indian domestic workers, those who are coming from with families where, say, they are married and they have spouses, the thing that I've come to notice is most of their spouses were also employed in informal economy. And during the lockdown and even post-lockdown, even that got disrupted for their spouses. So a comment on how those families are working, whether these were like part-time workers or whether these were full-time workers. What happens to families where even the spouse was a member of the informal economy and that got disrupted? Some comment on that would be appreciated. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So we'll go in order of the speakers. So Neha, Joyce, and Lorena, if you could take about a minute each, and then think about what you want to respond to, what you want to draw out as a kind of concluding comments. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Alpa. I think a minute would be too little. I've got some fantastic questions, and I'm going to try and actually club some of my responses together, if you don't mind. Okay, so I think, you know, Shalini sort of hit the nail on its head. These are very heterogeneous employment relations. And I think there's so much of diversity within domestic work sector. I think what the pandemic has also pushed us to think is, while we go ahead and try and understand who does domestic work, what are the different kind of working arrangements, I think it's also interesting to look at who the employer is, right? And who really takes a call on spending or outsourcing or spending money on paying for domestic work. And I think, you know, we saw a very interesting variety of responses. Some of these were also based on different generations responding very differently. So one could see a lot of younger working women come out proactively in support of domestic workers within RWA discussions. Whereas the older women sort of went back to doing a lot of the work within their households that domestic workers were doing. Now, also because of, you know, the whole issue of comorbidities and the fact that elderly people are more vulnerable, this becomes a really complex issue to look at. But I think in terms of employers, I think what's really interesting, and I think it came through from the other presentations as well, that I think what the state and the employers have done is that they're trying to basically renegotiate and depress wages further. That's what I think is overwhelmingly the sense. So what Lorena was talking about, you know, trying to restrict workers to work only in one household. And these are all tactics that one can really see as having been attempted in the Indian situation as well. So I think the other connected sort of angle to that is platformization. And I think during this time, one really sees a lot of, online companies or platforms actually pushing for varieties of formats in which domestic workers could be replaced through actually hiring workers through the platform economy. So I think it's really been an interesting period. And I think it will take slightly longer for us to reflect on some of these learnings. I just wanted to say, sort of touch upon one or two of the other things, questions that were asked. One is, I think Tom's question on body practices. I think it's very interesting to see that domestic workers who have been reluctant to wear masks and wear gloves in general, I mean, this is what you get from unions as well, right? Have actually taken them up. And this is also to sort of secure their jobs in the current context. But you know, it's again really interesting to see how there is growing discourse on looking at sort of safety in the workplace from the perspective of the employer, but not really from the perspective of the domestic worker. So I think it's about time we start talking about whether these masks and gloves are comfortable for workers to wear, right? And how they actually then influence the body practices where the worker can actually safeguard themselves. There is again interesting work on the fact that using sanitizers or overuse of disinfectants can actually harm the skin. But that's something that workers are reporting that they can't negotiate with their employers at the time, for the time being, given the situation of the pandemic, right? And I think I'll try and quickly just touch upon two bits. One is on Ratna's question, which is that will part-time domestic work decline? Ratna, I also have been asking the same question to trade unions, but the overwhelming impression is that it will not. Once we have the vaccine, there will be an increase in demand for part-time domestic work. But those employers who can afford to shift to hiring full-time domestic workers will do so. On the question of unpaid work and increasing domestic violence, I know a lot of people have sort of touched upon it. I think it's really interesting to see that, I mean, and ILO has done some work on this already. I'm happy to share the exact report with you via Shalini later on, if possible. But I think what is coming out through telephonic surveys is there's increased incidence of domestic violence, but also as has been rightly pointed out, you know, in one of the questions, that because men have gone back home and they don't have paid work, there is also an increased tension in the home, right? Because of this. So for those workers who are themselves domestic workers, they also see increased burdens of unpaid work that they really need to carry out. I think the hierarchization of work is also something that we see very clearly coming across. And that is something really to think about as to how it's actually renewing or reinforcing traditional perceptions around domestic work. I'm sorry, I don't think I've been able to do justice to all the questions, but I hope we can keep this conversation on. And do please feel free to reach out to me if you'd like more information on what the ILO does on this work.
Thanks so much, Neha. Thank you. Thank you. Joyce?
Yeah, I'll be quick. The first question about nationality of employees in the UK. I would say many domestic workers, when they enter the UK, they move very often with their employees from Middle Eastern countries, Singapore, and like Hong Kong. It's not surprising, so society is common to hire domestic workers, even professionals. However, once they arrive in the UK, very often they change employees. So I think the last survey, I did a small survey with 40 members like in the organization, shows that the nationalities of the employees are highly diverse, British, German, French. I would say I see a diversity of nationality of employees, because there's a danger here. Some people assume that abuse is from particular employees from particular countries. However, I don't see significant improvement even when they're working for American and European employees. I would say highly diverse. The second question is linked to mobilization. I mean, migrant domestic workers have been highly active in terms of mobilizing and organizing in the UK. Last month, we just launched a campaign to recommend the government to reinstate the pre-2012 overseas domestic work visa, which means they can allow them to renew the visa. I mean, the campaign is led by The Voice, Kalyan Anti-Slavery, TUC, and United Union. We launched the event. It is chaired by Labour MP, Jess Philip. It's last month. And also with the United Union, they have recently established a new branch, domestic worker branch, in April. I think it's a signal. I mean, they're really showing efforts to, you know, defend the decent work of domestic workers. I think they have been really active in the UK. Yeah. I mean, another very quick point about relational aspect of domestic work. I think this is really important. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about virtual motherhood. I mean, in the Filipino cases, very often, I mean, those children are left behind, but once they grow up, they become domestic workers abroad as well. There's a lot of generational relational aspects, but I won't have time to elaborate, but it's an important theme. Yeah.
Thank you, Joyce. And over to you, Lorena.
Okay, thank you very much for the comments. They're very interesting insight for the discussion. I would just address maybe one or two questions, particularly Ratna question about the long-term changes in the working arrangement. We saw here is since, 20 years ago, an increase of part-time work, particularly short hours for multiple employers. And this is the workers who are less protected by the regulation, because the legislator in 2013 imagined that the most common arrangement was full-time job. And during this time, particularly with middle-class employer, they saw the opportunity to just hire workers for a few hours. And as Neha said, platform work started to take an important role in this sector, because platform work allowed the employers to hire domestic workers for easily for a few hours a week. And I think that in the long term, we will see more hourly work, and it will be complicated because these are the workers who are more informally informal workers, and they don't have access to social security benefits because of the framework, the legal framework. And the question about coronavirus virus carriers and how employers and domestic workers saw the situation, I could say that the narrative here was that the employers were the carriers of coronavirus because they came from Europe and United States, and the workers were the one who was in risk, and they were the one who feel protected by the government lockdown to be able to not to go to the employer house and take the risk of being infected. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Lorena. I'd like to just say thank you, huge thank you to everybody. If people want to stay on, maybe we can leave the screen open for a little bit if people want to have an informal chat. But before we do that, just wanted to say a huge, huge thank you to Yaneha, to Lorena, to Joyce for these great presentations, and Louise and Shalini for, you know, thinking through with us those presentations, and all the audience for being here and your questions, which have all been great and helped us draw some of the comparisons and also similarities and differences and think the issues through together. Okay, so just wanted to say to everybody.